I mean, honestly, in terms of the costume, there's one scene in Rio where he turns up with, you know, sunglasses with the gold chain round and like a purple lilac sequined chemise and like thing, and I'm like, you look like someone's aunt. I really feel like you're about to bust out a tray of sangria. It is really strange. Like, good for you for trying something different, but like, is it margarita hour? That's what it feels like.
Love for the tea chat last week.
Well, I've got more tea chat for you, James.
Oh, God, guys, strap in. Because we did like 8.5 minutes last week.
Basically, the cameras could have been off or on. It didn't matter. We were just going to talk about tea. Because in the intervening time between this last episode and this episode, more than enough tea. No, I went for a few days away to the Cotswolds, which is beautiful. I've never been there before, but like, holy crap, just lovely. You know, great weather, lots of lovely walks. It's a bit, it is biscuits in Britain. It is steam trains, you know, walking down to the pub and stuff.
Little paper towns.
Quaint and quintessential. But while I was there, not only did I have a lot of cream teas, and, you know, they do the thing where they bring out the tea and they bring in the hot water as well. I love that. But I bought myself a new teapot, James. And
China?
No. No China. I bought myself an enamel teapot.
Okay.
So it's metal. Because when I'm looking at this metal teapot, and already I see, not only do I like the glaze on it, but when you're buying a teapot, the thing you've got to be careful about is the pour. You're looking at the spout, because you can buy a teapot and some, if they're badly made,
you're there with a protractor, like doing the angles.
If you pour the liquid out of it and it just spurts everywhere, some teapots have a bad pour, but I can tell from this pour, this pot had a good pour.
Science. It's gonna be like, you know, those like hotel fountains that like have a continuous stream of like uninterrupted water. That's what you're going for.
And the reason I bought an enamel one, because I was like, it's metal, so that will conduct the heat and keep the thing hot much longer. You know, it's not a sink heat. I'm not as you can tell, James, I'm not a physicist.
No.
But you know, ceramic absorbs heat, but metal gets hot.
Is it metal on the inside or the outside the whole way?
Well, it's metal but glazed in ceramic. An enamel.
Yeah, because if it was all metal, in an enamel, the heat would diffuse out.
Well, it is inherently
conduct.
Metal.
That's yes, what but it as is. Long as it's wrapped in. So if it's metal on the inside, hot
all
quickly.
Of it is glazed. All of it is glazed. But the inherent properties
What's
of it is that it's metal, which means that it gets hot really quickly, right? And then it gets like hot like a proper teapot. Hot.
Yeah.
So when you make the tea now, I digress. James, the point is, I bought this teapot and I come home and I finally make a pot of tea in it, and it is like amazing.
You're loving
it's amazing. And I thought the listeners need to know this.
That's
the
good.
Steam coming out of it.
Oh, you love it. Give yourself a little facial when you open it up.
Yeah. It's terrific. So I hope you.
We had a lot of love for the tea chat. People are like, I thought I came here for the films, but I actually realized I came here for the tea.
We are, you know, we're multidimensional people. We love things beyond film.
Yeah. When we press record, we don't just go out and down. Like over the years we've done this podcast, I've gotten lazier and lazier at putting all of this kit away, because like your chances are you're coming over in 3-4 days. So now the mics don't go away.
Yeah.
Like, I just wind them. For a couple of weeks, like there'll be times where I just don't put the light away. I'm just like, I cannot be asked to do it. Cameras have to go.
Yeah.
But there's gonna be a time where I'm like, George, just stay there now. Yeah. This is where you live.
I live there.
A week will go by. I'm like, oh, it's time to do the podcast.
Let's get George out the cupboard again. Blow him up
I'll just like strap a VR headset to your face. You know, you can like go to the cinema in VR.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And
be
like, I'll do that for you, and then you can see all the films and
say
goodbye to your
pretend
family.
Pretend I go
your
home.
Job.
Yeah. So James, you through your other side of yourself, which does exist, your day job, you actually got to go to the TV BAFTAs the other
Completely
day.
Completely unrelated to this, was not invited. Not that I think we would be in that, not as an influencer capacity.
I'm sure we were just the one on the
one
other
off the
list.
Because there was, I saw Munya, the TikToker there. Yeah. He was the only TikToker, if we're going to call ourselves, if we were to be invited, it would be capacity as a TikToker.
And he has considerably more followers.
He has a few million, a few million and a few hundred thousand more than us. So he was the only TikToker I was there. And I was like, you fucking bastard, I'm coming for everything you are. No, went to the BAFTAs. It was really cool. So we're filming some branded stuff there, and this job came in like a month before, and it's like, oh, do you want to do some filming at the BAFTAs? And I was like,
I love TV.
Yeah, loves to. And then we had like this, the red carpet was huge, and it was in the South Bank Royal Festival Hall. Obviously I didn't go into the actual ceremony. Like I saw them doing sound check, but like we just had a bit on the red carpet. There's like big chunks to the red carpet. There's like this first bit where you get sort of like a video production spot allocation, and then as the celebrities pour in, you basically just like yank them over and get them to do a piece to camera. BAFTA had like their own, and then like other TV and online things basically like have all these TV things. Then there's like the second phase of the red carpet, which is just like open pap, open press, pa 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 pa. Yeah. You've got some fans lining up there, and it was really cool. I saw a lot of famous people. There was this interesting point where once the celebs have done their like video bits, there is a queue for a photo wall to have your official photo against the wall. And it's weird because like you've never seen celebrities queue.
Yes, that's right.
I got to see celebrities queue. It's celebrities you don't think exist in the same world queue next to each other. So, and I'm standing like as close as I am to you now, trying to awkwardly film them. And I'm seeing Cillian Murphy, Stephen Merchant, and Spencer Matthews from Made in Chelsea queue together. And I'm like, this is just weird.
Chatting with each other?
Ish. Sort of like conversing. Nobody was really like, a little bit of chat, but not, like everyone had someone that they were with.
Right.
So they were sort of like passing hellos, or like Lee Mack next to like that person. I was like, this is just a weird like melding of worlds. So that was really cool. And then there are certain celebrities who don't have to queue. Kate Winslet, George. She doesn't queue.
Oh, really?
Gary Oldman doesn't queue. I actually thought Cillian Murphy could not queue. Maybe once Oppenheimer comes out, he won't have to queue.
Because they're film actors who happen to be doing TV.
Yeah, like he's sort of graduating from his Peaky Blinders thing. And like, you know, you got like Anton Deck, and I saw Jason Isaacs. So Martin Freeman, very easy to spot. He always wears a colourful suit.
Just the thing, sorry, but you say they don't queue. Does that mean they have to like, they just push past all the other people queuing?
Yeah, like, it's like, imagine like at the beginning of the red carpet, it's actually quite fast moving. But like once everyone starts turning up at once, like, that's people are like told you need to get your photo done here, and just a natural queue starts to happen.
Yeah.
And there'll be like sort of 20 plus people waiting to get their photo so they can actually just move on through. But then like, you know, Kate Winslet turns up. She's not gonna stand there.
No.
And Kate Winslet, I mean, class, you know, apps, like just radiating star quality, a veteran of the red carpet, just oozing cool. And she was with her daughter, who was also nominated. And
she just glided in.
Just glides and just looks amazing, like has just an air of confidence and star quality. It's sort of an undescribable, intangible feeling of someone that's just definitely better than you in every way.
Wow.
But yeah, it's cool.
That sounds very fun. And I've seen Kate Winslet in interviews, and she seems very nice.
She does seem nice. But I had a very weird amount of access. So like, it's very protective. You're not really allowed to walk around with a camera. I mean, you and I, when we've done red carpet stuff, we've been told very clearly, do not bring a big camera.
Yeah.
It's very political about, you know, the press are allocated their spot. Yeah. You can't just walk around and get better imagery than they do when they fight for their spot. But I was technically with a video camera on the carpet, and we've sort of told to stay in this area, but I was sort of always also instructed, like, if you can get like shots of people on the camera, like, obviously don't take the piss, but like, be there. So I'm sort of just like, I made friends with the security, and I kind of just roamed around the red carpet, and other people were like, how are you allowed to do this? And I was like, I don't know,
two
but
words,
it's great.
I'll get you. They know me.
And it was a really sunny day, so I took my jacket, it's black tie, but I took my jacket off, so I'm like tall in a white shirt, and I had so many people sending me screenshots of different media outlets of me in the back, just like looking, trying to find people.
It's the most squinting I've ever seen you do,
it was like really hot. And like Daisy May Cooper was there, she was great energy, she like loved, she was like really happy to be there. It was like, oh my god, that person's here, and she was like hugging all the fans.
I saw her do a bit with Taron Egerton, which is really funny.
Yeah, I saw Taron Egerton.
Again, two worlds that I didn't know.
That's what I found weird. It's like TV and like high prestige actor people and comedians and like Joel Dommett next to whoever. Like
Joel who?
Oh, never mind. And sorry. Yeah, like just people next to people you didn't think. And I was like, I've never seen this person queue. I always thought celebrities never queued, but they do queue.
Yeah.
And then I got like behind, you know, when they like all the press are lined up and they're doing all these interviews.
Yeah.
I got to go like behind them and just like get my own little version of their interview. Like, I don't know.
Pirating.
Any of that footage can be used. Yeah. It might be like, that's like illegal footage, but I had a really good time just people watching for the day.
One day, James.
One day.
One day.
Ramesh Ranganathan and Rob Beckett were hosting.
Yeah, good. I didn't see anyone on TV, so.
I saw them warming up, and then on the red carpet, I was like, hi, Ramesh and Rob. Is it okay if I get a shot of you waving to my camera? They were like, yeah, sure. And then they like waved. Really, they were like joking.
Yeah, well, because Ramesh is so deadpan.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, great. Well, I've had a good time. And one day, James, we'll walk the carpet.
One day we'll go.
And there'll be another person on the video saying, excuse me, James.
Oh, I'd love to get a video of you.
20,000 right now.
Yeah.
Welcome to episode 77. That's big.
Is it?
77 is like 1977 when Star Wars came out. That's just like a lot of big
lower
number.
Your expectations for this episode.
If you're joining us for the first time, welcome to Pulp Kitchen.
Which I know some people are.
Some people are.
The show grows.
Who the hell are these guys? They're probably thinking. We'll be talking about film and TV today. Probably just film, actually. Yeah. We have no TV to talk about today, but we talk about film. And we should get on with that. We've got a couple of film reviews to do. And we'll have some games at the end and some emails. And for all our returning listeners, hi,
how
guys.
You doing?
So great to have you back.
Get in here.
I hope you've had a great
Come
week.
Come on.
Yeah.
Don't be shy.
Take your shoes off, sit back, relax. Yeah. Let's have a nice time. Let's talk about some movies.
So we're actually recording about, last time we recorded was about 10 days ago, but frustratingly, we actually managed to see a screening of a film called Sisu after we recorded. So we're a little bit late talking about it, but the film is now out. We managed to get a chance to see it early at the Central, Picture House Central.
Yes, again, nice cinema.
Very nice cinema. Very, you know what, huge screen that was very loud. Yes. But like for this film, I actually appreciated how loud and sort of, imposing it was. This one's called Sisu, and I don't know if you guys have seen any marketing posters for it. It's a very wearied, wrinkled, hairy, grainy, dirty man with little hairs flicking about and a big knife over the front of his forehead with flecks of gold blood. And Sisu is a Finnish film directed by Halmari Helander and stars Hjorma Tomila. And I'm already going to apologize for the pronunciation of these Finnish names, which I know I've probably butchered. And Sisu is set in the sort of latter part of World War II in 1944. In Finland, and it is basically set in the countryside in Finland. We're sort of given a brief blurb of what's sort of happening in the war, and basically after ravaging parts of the nation, the Nazis have essentially ordered to move out and are leaving a desolation in their wake.
A scorched earth.
And I assume it's shot in sort of that part of Finland because it's very much got a sense of place and location. And we start with our silent protagonist. What was the name of the silent protagonist? Atami.
Just
doesn't really matter.
Dirty man, wild man, gold man.
Our silent protagonist, who is he lives wild with the earth amongst the fjords, and he is a prospector who digs for gold. And at the beginning of the film, he finds a big lump of gold in the ground.
And it's literally just like, him in a tent and his dog and a horse.
Yes.
That's
simple life. And he strikes gold and the gold glows in his eyes and radiates all over him.
It's very atmospheric soundtrack. It's not serious,
amazing sort of wide cinematography soaring through the landscape, this sense of like impending doom and dread, and this guttural, earthy soundtrack sort of really sets the tone. And it is like a bunch of really, what I imagine, really large Finnish men with beards in a church in Reykjavik, which I know is Iceland, but like I've been to the church where they...
Oh, right, you think
you know that famous church that sort of goes like that in Reykjavik?
No.
It's an architecture.
I've never been to Reykjavik.
It's like, it kind
I
of
think there are Finnish
like
people. I was screaming that you've just conflated the two countries.
I know I'm conflated too, but they record loads of that type of music and audio in this. It looks like an organ. The church looks like a massive. I've been. It's fantastic. And they recorded the God of War soundtrack there, for anyone who knows, with Per McCreary. But anyway, sorry. There's this we are. It's like that. And the Nazis are obviously like imposing on the people.
And we also, you see like flickers of war. You see like explosions off of the horizon. Bombers coming overhead. There's just the hint of war is over there.
And also the sense that it's moving and retreating and ever sort of ebb and flowing. Meanwhile, we have two sort of remaining squadrons of Nazi soldiers that are left, basically all sort of drained, dirtied, slumped over the roof of a tank in the back of a car with a couple of prisoners moving through the landscape, being told these are their orders. But who do they come across on the horse like a cowboy? It is our Sisu.
Yeah.
And someone realizes that the person that they've encountered not only has gold on him, but they've actually bumped into someone of legendary status. And they know who this person is. And they're like, there is this saying that happens when a man is at the very end of his life. It's this last breath of strength and endurance. We do not have a word to translate it, but in Finland we call it Sisu.
Yeah.
Sisu scorched screen. And what follows is Sisu being hunted down for the gold, which he possesses by these Germans. And he's basically trying to get it into town to sell it. And yeah, I think, you know, we can draw lots of very clear influences from Tarantino, Mad Max,
Westerns,
Die Hard, Westerns in general. It's a short 90-minute film.
Yeah, but tight.
Which was definitely tight, and it's very heavily chaptered. I think it was 6 or 7 chapters, like big splash on the screen, telling you exactly what you're about to...
A very pulpy yellow textual writing.
Yes, that sort of stamped yellow, like very much indicative of Tarantino. Yeah, George, Sisu, how did you get on with it?
So that's it. So you're very well described, and I hope people have kind of got a good picture of it now. So Sisu...
Wildly violent as well.
Unbelievably
violent.
It sounds like a war film, but it really is a Western, really.
Yeah.
It's one man on a horse, as you say... You know,
I also think that the World War II setting is almost happenstance. It could have been set in all sorts of different.
He could have been coming across like a stagecoach, stage wagon, bandits, whatever. But it's just they've updated it and given it kind of a nice sort of World War II spin. Because in doing so, you get these great, you know, evil German villains with SS hats, and one of the SS commander has these boots that have metal teeth on the cap.
Just in case you didn't know, they weren't bad guys.
Yeah. Just in case you didn't know, they're dressed all in black and have skulls on the cap. Sisu is... Here's the thing with Sisu. It's 90 minutes.
Yeah.
It doesn't really have any depth. It doesn't really have any themes. But what it is a really sharp execution of going from point A to point B and having as much fun and as delivering as many sort of weird and well-executed set pieces along the way.
Yeah.
I think you and I, when we came out of it, we don't try to talk about films because obviously we saved it for this. But what we did say is how sparse and concise it was. And this is a film that really is very show, don't tell. The dialogue is incredibly minimal.
I said to you when I came out, you could easily lose every piece of dialogue if you wanted. The film worked visually without the use of dialogue. Yeah. And when characters did speak, it was only to service the raising of tension.
Yes.
So it was providing context for who it was they had stumbled across, like stories of this man who had taken down 100 Russian soldiers himself, and he's impossible to kill. And then also, like, increasing tension for certain scenes. So, like, with someone, there were, like, two people who were like, where's he gone?
Yeah.
And it was, you didn't have to do that, but it was raising the stakes. Like, there's just no wasted words.
Exactly.
Everything was there to contribute to tension.
And it's a real skill to do that.
Yeah.
It's a real nice exercise because it immediately makes you as an audience lean in and engage and really look at the images that are happening in front of you and how they work together. There are some, you know, it doesn't scrimp on the violence.
No.
It's really big, gory, bloody stuff. And, you know... It's heavily genre-fied, like this whole idea of finding someone who's an old warhorse who actually turns out to be somebody from you've called out of retirement. It's John Wick.
I'm officially claiming a new genre, which is men being dragged out of retirement and having to commit last acts of violence for a greater good.
It's the good shepherd turned like war person, and that happens in this. I will say that Sisu is at best like a big Friday night beers, pizza, see it with your mates kind of movie.
100%.
And we had a good time seeing it, but like I particularly the friends who I see horror films with regularly, I was like, oh, I wish I'd seen it with like a big group of friends and we would have got a lot of laughs out of that and joy. Because it is.
And it's funny, it's got real like slapstick violence.
Yeah, and actually sometimes to its detriment because it is, a lot of it is silly. Some of it is ridiculous.
Oh, it's insane.
And some of it, once or twice, I was just like, that is just stupid. The bit, it's not the violence that that caught it out. It's not the violence that caught it out. There's one bit where
match.
It's a bit where someone goes to refuel. They're looking for gasoline, and like this guy's got a jerry can. He's like looking at this abandoned fuel station, but he's got a fucking huge cigar lit. And I'm like, you're at a fuel station. What are you doing? You could go up any minute. There's some bits with improbable use of bodies as bullet shields.
Oh yeah.
Remember when he throws the mine onto the guy's forehead?
How did he get the mine up?
But like despite that, it did a good job, I think. It is ridiculous.
Yeah.
There are moments where I think the whole audience laughs at the ridiculousness of it. But
the
I think that laugh I feel is everyone kind of on board for it.
Yes.
I think there's moments like right up until the end where you know, I'll just say that the plane bit when you realize what he's trying to do with the plane. And I'm like, this is just so insane that this is going to happen. But I'm almost like, you've escalated the ridiculousness slowly over the course of 90 minutes.
Yeah.
You've not wasted my time with like useless bits of dialogue. So I'm actually like on board to see how ridiculous it can go. And it never really sort of annoyed me. I just thought it's good fun. Nobody's taking it too seriously.
Totally. And that's it. That's all it needs to be. A 90-minute serviceable,
pure fun,
good pure fun thing with like really like strong violence, a kind of tongue-in-cheek sense of humor.
Beautifully shot as well. Beautifully shot. Use of the
landscape. It does have the thing where all the Nazis speak English. There's a mixture, and you have some Danish actors and some English
Jack
actors
Doolin also
doing slightly English.
I heard this man took down 100 soldiers alone.
But the dialogue is really actually like very generically American. It's like, get rid of your sorry ass out of here.
Yeah.
This guy's one bad motherfucker. Yeah. It's like, they wouldn't even like, even like English speaking Germans, like, which is just strange. But it's a good fun.
I wouldn't have been surprised if there had been like a Lieutenant Aldo Rain-esque character like walk in, like just larger than life. Never really seen anyone like him. Kind of thing.
So yeah, I think if you catch this is one, it's just that tight 90 that you can just throw on and have a good fun with people. If you really kind of suspend your disbelief and just let the skill of its concision and its tightness just work. It's basically, it's almost like a video game, isn't it? It's not there to serve anything else. It's just to get set piece to set piece.
I feel like you could easily sort of look at Mad Max Fury Road and say this very much looked at that and said, how can we tell a really tight story just using visuals and action and communicate emotion and progression just by doing that and not just depend on story building. Yeah. There's one scene where it does story building. It tells you exactly who.
Here comes the exposition dump.
And then that's it. And it's 5 minutes and then it moves on.
I will say as well, just on a side point, we saw it at the Picture House Centre, which is very good. And there was a bit. Well, I don't know if you saw this because you were kind of sat to my right, but
in front of us.
Yeah, in front,
completely separately to the film.
Yeah, a guy in front of us. And you know, this was a screening, so there's industry people here. I was very
surprised. You've been invited by industry.
Yeah, to be there.
And there's an assumption of just the audience would be better behaved. It's not like random people coming off the street.
I know. Anyway, so this guy in front, about 10 minutes in, like gets his phone out, and obviously we can all see it because it's very bright. And he's not actually recording, he's trying to take a photo of the stuff. But
it's like, what?
But you're immediately like, so I'm immediately distracted, but I'm like, what are you doing? And these two old geezers next to me actually were just straight on it. And this, he like kicked the back of the guy's chair and it was like, hey, it's recording. And obviously he motioned to the ushers, and the ushers were straight in saying, you can't do that, you can't record. And this guy's sort of reaction was like, what? I'm not doing
he's asked to leave, right? And
we're near the front of the cinema. There's a lot of people. So everyone can see this happening.
We're in the front of the cinema. Usher's come over, has asked him to leave. He's got a bright phone screen. And instead of just leaving quietly, he stands up to face the audience. He goes, he looks like my friend. What am I going to do? He looks like my friend. Like, as if we'd all go, oh, don't let him take a picture. It looks like his friend that we all care about.
Yeah.
Who is that?
And like, obviously, like, not only is obviously photographing and videoing films in a cinema illegal,
it's just like a really clear law.
Yeah, it's just like etiquette. What are you here? What are you trying to get off your fucking phone, mate? So, but good on the ushers again, straight on it as well. And I should say, when I went to see Fast X, it was like the Men in Black were just like lining up against the wall.
Yeah.
And they were like, do not take your phone out. At any point, I thought, if I took my phone out in Fast X, Vin Diesel was going to jump through with a car and just take off my head.
Jason Momoa just snaps your neck from behind. I have seen clips on, you mentioned this the other day, you talk about Guardian spoilers going on social media. I've seen people on my TikTok, last scene of Fast X, it like filmed from a cinema, and I'm like, oh my God.
I just opened my laptop to get some points ready for when we review it in a second. Yeah. And the mid-credits thing is an article in The Independent.
So
and I'm like,
weird.
Well, that's just killed the whole thing. I will say it's probably the most interesting thing in the entire film, but we'll get onto that. Yeah. But it is a shame that films, their lifespan is just cut like immediately.
Yeah.
It's online, you can see it, whatever. And there's nothing really film companies could do to shut it down. But yeah, guys, don't get your phone out.
And if you're invited to a screening, like,
I know. I
would shut someone down in like any cinema if they were filming with their phone.
But it's screening, it's particularly
I've seen kids doing that. I've seen kids like Snapchatting pictures of a film that they're watching.
I did like, last year when I went to see Top Gun Maverick at the premiere. There's people, somebody, the guy in front was recording one of the scenes, and I
And then they left, actually, which is really
And weird. This is like a 10, 11-year-old girl who was with her dad. And I'm like, how... I understand, like...
Put your phone away, kids.
Just put it away and watch... Anyway, sorry.
Anyway.
Aside from the rant
that,
of...
So Sisu...
It's well really, really good fun and well-executed.
Well-executed, tight, finished film. That's called Sisu, and it's out now. Okay, as we just mentioned, I had gone to see Fast X this week. It's another film that we're going to see.
Are we saying 10 or X?
Well, I'm saying X actually because it sounds better. Saying Fast 10, you're right. It is a Roman numeral, but
it's the 10th or 11th.
You're right. I've been saying Fast X like it's a kiss, like it's Fast
a Roman numeral. I mean, look, there's famously the in no joke. Consistency. There's no consistency. No. It's just whatever they found. Fate of the Furious was when we knew that it was just a bit of a
whatever you need.
Yeah. When? Sorry, I know you haven't seen it. I'm trying to think if. When we watched Fast Five, were there five of them?
There were five,
like
yes,
the
there
Fast
were.
Fast Five. That's
there were five people. You mean?
Yeah.
No, there were just been five films. No, I remember like, when Fast like Five Fast came Fast out, five. And it was Fast Five: colon, Rio Heist.
Yes.
As if to clarify to people where this movie is set and just what kind so of genre know. It is.
Yeah. sprawling, such is the Fast and Furious films.
Well, this is interesting because I've been to see it, and I should say that I have not seen a single Fast and Furious
yes.
film. I vaguely saw one. On a ferry in 2005 from England to France. Okay, that's my so too fast, too furious. That was
my ferry going from Gilead to Bali was showing Fast. I don't know, 7 or 8.
Maybe it's weird exclusivity deal with ferries. Yeah.
Netflix, no, thank you. Indonesian ferries going.
So look, I went to see it because a friend of mine works in the industry and he had a spare ticket and invited me. And I thought, look, I thought it'd be an interesting exercise to just. Walk into this franchise 10 films in. I am aware of the culture around these films. I am aware what they're about. I'm aware of the family. Jokes about family. And I know Vin Diesel and obviously Paul Walker and, you know, the whole thing with The Rock. Mm. And I am aware of the kind of preposterousness of it, the kind of silliness of it. And I was totally fine with that. I was open to it. I know these films can get very long. But I thought it would be an interesting exercise as an outsider to go and see this. And the friend I saw it with, who was much more up to speed with the franchise, saw it at the Cineworld Leicester Square IMAX.
Yeah.
Huge screen. And I think before I go into Fast X, I'm just going to call it Fast X, is that whatever I say next, it is irrelevant. Because we're 10 films into this franchise. Yeah. Nothing
11,
is stopping.
Technically. Hobbs and Shaw.
Yeah, 11 films technically. We are, nothing is stopping it. You know, this franchise is going to exist and continue regardless of what happens with it. And every time a Fast film comes out, it's very popular for people to come out and go, oh my God, it's so preposterous and silly and shake their fist at it. And it almost seems like passé to do that now because we know that these films are preposterous and ridiculous, even though I've not seen them, but I'm just aware that's their reputation.
Yeah.
But having said that, I will give you my thoughts regardless of what I thought about Fast X. So let's just get the story of Fast X down. So as you summarised, I think when we were talking about it off air, it's like somebody from Dominic Toretto's past comes back to threaten his family and his legacy and puts him in peril. Yes, that's
And then they join the group, the
gang.
That's what's happening. They just turn good and join the gang.
What's happening? Dominic Toretto lives in, I think, Los Angeles. He has a son. He's with Michelle Rodriguez and he has his family. And his family... is, you know, Ludacris and Tyrese Gibson. And we get his grandmother, played by Rita Moreno from West Side Story, coming in, who dressed in a white jumpsuit like she's Elvis. Yeah. Great for a scene, but like, whatever. You also have Charlize Theron's character. You also have John Cena, who was the villain in the last one, who's now, because he was Dom's
as well as
long
Jason
lost...
Jason Statham. Yeah,
Jason Statham, and who was Dom's long lost brother.
Dwayne The Rock Johnson for him and Vin Diesel fell out.
Yes, exactly. And then you have... Brie Larson turning up.
Yeah,
Oscar winner Brie Larson. So a stacked cast. If you look at the poster, it's really big. And Jason Momoa. Jason Momoa is the big villain this time. And we'll get to that. And something in the past has brought this thing to the future. And oh, there's a reckoning coming, Dom. You know, we'll look out for it.
I'm sorry, is this part one of like the final thing?
Three. It's the part one of the fight. They were good. It's the end of the road begins. It was going to be Fast X part one. And now it's going to be like, they were going to do then Fast X Part 2. Now there's going to be another 3. So it's the final, they're doing a final trilogy of
films. So they're
going
to do X Parts 2 and 3.
Yes.
They're not going to do 11, 12.
No, they're going to do Fast X Part 1, Fast X Part 2, Fast X Part 3. God. I know, it's ridiculous. Somewhere someone has fallen on a keyboard when typing in these titles. Yeah. Anyway, look, here's the thing to say about the Fast and Furious X, Fast and Furious 10. James, I really tried. Mm. I really tried to go into this and be open-minded and enjoy it from every single possible angle. I tried to think of it as turn your brain off, just enjoy the action, the spectacle, or try and enjoy it for its sort of scale and its preposterousness. Try and enjoy it ironically. Mm. Try and enjoy it with the mate of mine. But I couldn't, James. It's bad and it's really, really boring. That's the thing. It's 2 hours and 20 minutes of visual noise, okay? Mm. It is everything I feared it would be and more. I mean, again, ranting about it is kind of pointless. People always do this every time a fast film comes out. But just broadly speaking, like, the editing's terrible. The pacing's terrible. The dialogue's terrible. There is no story. Dominic Toretto is one of the single most boring lead characters I've ever come across. He is a blank canvas of nothing. He is a banter black hole. Vin Diesel is a potato. He is just a potato on
He's
screen.
He's one word. He's a one line family vessel. Just to,
and his growl has got out of control. Oh, he has. Deep. He has swallowed an engine, a car engine, and he just.
You got my family.
And I'm like, what is going on? But there are things that happened in this film, big dramatic things, and his reaction is just so minimal and minute. It's like when a few weeks ago when I talked about Bob Odenkirk talking about Steven Seagal, it's like, you know, have you ever spoken to a rock? It's like, this is it. It's Vin Diesel's most wooden performance and he's played a tree, okay? Like, it doesn't make any sense. But that's the center of the whole film. And it's him in, I counted, three different denim cut-off shirts.
Of course.
But that's all he wears
with his, you know, cross and family.
Yeah. And you've got a whirlwind of talent around him trying to, you know, Michelle Rodriguez trying to just like make him seem like a normal human being and make him seem like a father. Yeah, it's lots of that. Yeah. Damn. So Jason Momoa turns up.
You see the one when Michelle Rodriguez gets, she can't remember it, she gets amnesia and she tries to kill them, but then they jog her memory in
you
the end.
You know what, doesn't surprise me.
Six or seven.
Anyway, so that's that thing. I really struggle with that. I think, like, the pacing and the dialogue is so, the dialogue is really poor. So none of the jokes land. There are so many long scenes that aren't the car scenes, right? And just sort of hang there.
Yeah.
The pacing is really weird. You'll have a scene start and then it'll quickly end. And every scene ends with someone going, "Don't worry, I know a guy." Or, "Don't worry, let's get some gear." Yeah. I'm just building and building. I think, like, all the things that you would assume with that. Even taking the dialogue aside, if I was like, I want to enjoy the spectacle, I want to enjoy the stuff. The scenes of action aren't actually that well shot. I didn't like the actual scenes of hand-to-hand combat and shooting.
They're filmed very tightly.
They're filmed very tightly and they're cut like taken three. You know, they're cut so quickly. I can't even follow what's happening. So apparently, you know, Dom's just dispatched three, you know, squads of SWAT team people, but like I couldn't even tell. It's just a lot of noise. Go on.
Was there a moment, I've not seen this, was there a moment in the third act where one of the good female characters and one of the bad female characters got locked in a room, but they fought and it was like, we're women, so we're gonna have a fight.
That happens every film. Yeah, it was. It's even in the trailer.
Michelle Rodriguez, they got Ronda Rousey.
Michelle Rodriguez and Charlize Theron.
Yeah, it's always like the girls that have a big fight.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
But there are like four different films happening. You've got something with Charlize Theron. John Cena turns up and basically does like a father figure camp comedy bit with Dom's son. You've got a whole thing in. There's a bit where they go to London. Yeah. And you have lots of B-roll of London, but then like you cut down in the alleyways and I'm like, you're on a soundstage in Burbank. And there's a really bizarre random cameo with Pete Davidson, which they're meant to be in London and they just don't care about the pretense of where they're meant to be.
Yeah.
So he's there, American, someone knocks into something. He says, that's going to be like $3,000 worth of damage. I'm like, you're meant to be in like Southwark. Yeah, well, this doesn't make any sense. Okay, but all that aside, having someone like me just like rant about Fast and Furious is kind of, like I said, I could be here all day, till blue in the face, it won't make any difference. But I was sitting there, I was thinking, why isn't this working? What is it that isn't entertaining on any way? And I think the reason is this. For a film that's about death-defying stunts and, you know, cars leaping off of things and nitrous oxide boosts and all that kind of stuff, all that kind of big scale stuff, the film actually takes no risks. This is a film in which any dramatic situation, any conflict, any serious moment of threat can be CGI'd away with a car stunt. A car stunt that obeys no laws of physics.
So you didn't fear for your characters?
Not
really.
Once at all. No. Any issue can be teched away. Tech, I'll just hack
I
it to the mainframe.
Ludacris's story.
I'll just tech.
In the first films, Ludacris was like a mechanic who did street races by night. Yeah. And then you cut like six films later and he's like, I'm hacking into the Pentagon.
He's like a quantum physicist in this. Yeah. He's like, oh, this is a bomb with like a triple axle core. And you got to, what?
Ludacris did so well getting cast in the Fast and Furious and whatever film.
But like, so you anything can be teched away and explained away. And like the CGI thing is a real point because you have set pieces where they just go, and then the car will just do this, this, and this. And you're like, that is not possible in the universe for that thing
they
to happen.
No, I know. Part of the charm,
but the problem,
yes.
but they just say, yeah, but we'll just CGI it so the car kind of does that. But the problem is me as an audience member, it's kind of subconscious. Your brain goes, well, I know what I'm watching is not real. And whenever it got to the third act when there were big threats, I was like, yeah, but I know what you're going to do. You're just going to do a rubbery CGI car thing, which wouldn't be possible in the real world.
You're not convinced by the CG at film 10, 11, and you think they'd have budget.
Because it doesn't... Obviously, all blockbuster films use CGI and kind of suspend the feeling of disbelief in a way. But with this, it's just like, that's just not real. You've kind of... There is no internal logic... For no rules. The film doesn't obey by any rules because anytime it comes into the friction or the obstacle of a rule, it just goes, oh, we'll just get around that. You can almost see Vin Diesel in the writer's room leaning over the writer's going, we'll just write around that. Well, he can just get in a car and do that, can't he? Oh, they got a problem with that. Well, they can just hack into that. They can get a plane onto that. This film takes place in like six different continents within the space of a week. It's really,
like,
really
wow,
strange.
They're not jet-lagged.
That's my issue is that there are no threats in this. So that's why I was quite bored by the end. It's just like, because someone's going to turn up, but they'll be very good at killing them, and then they'll be able to tech themselves out of that. And oh good, yeah, the stakes are raised for the third act, but it doesn't matter because you'll be able to rubber CGI this away and flip it there. And it's like the old David Mitchell and Webb, you know, the Mitchell and Webb sketch about the BMX bandit, which is like, don't worry, I can pop a wheelie and then I'm going to do a three. And so I mean, I'm not joking. There was a bit in the third act where I genuinely laughed out loud in disbelief because I was thinking, how are they getting away with this? How are they getting away with this? We are 11.
You're getting away with this.
It's 11 films in. People in the audience were enjoying it. Yeah. But I was like, there was something that happens in the third act, but I'm going to say with two cars and someone in a car and another car. And I thought that it was so unbelievable, so ridiculous. I thought, you can't be serious. You can't be serious. So my question is this, and if anyone's listening, please write in. Who's getting something out of this? If you saw this film and you got something out of it, please let us know, because I really struggled to get anything from this. And I'm like I said, I'm trying to turn my brain off. I wasn't trying to overthink it. Can I enjoy it in any way? But no, it's just... preposterous, ludicrous, no pun intended.
Yeah. It's Tyrese Gibson.
Also, Jason Momoa, like,
yeah, how is
God bless him, because the script is so, I mean, there's the lines in this that are so bad. It's like, if this gets out, the threat will be existential. Just, and then someone in an agency room. Oh, that's the other thing. The agency in this amorphous, not CIA, not FBI. Just, again, it's just like, well, the agency can just do anything we want them to. If we want them to have covert ops and out, they can do that. If they want to have a big plane, we just give them anything. There's no thing. And Jason Momoa, like, God bless him. He it's a classic case of someone who is a big star and is given a very badly written villain, and he is trying so hard to make this villain interesting.
He's got cool clothes.
Well, in this one, what he's clearly decided to do is that you've got this hyper-masculine world of cars and street racing, and also a whole world I just really find so boring. As a man watching it, I'm just like, I don't find cars and like bright lights and just I find it so stupid, right?
You're like a good ceramic teak.
Enamel teapot. Enamel. Anyway, but in the context of that, Jason Momoa is trying to do something different. What he's doing, he's playing the villain as flamboyant. So you have this hulking master Jason Momoa. He's
snakeskin jacket.
Well, he's not doing what John Cena did, and he's not doing what I assume The Rock did or whatever. He's just trying to be much more flamboyant and like, which I appreciate a little bit. There's a joke with him painting his toenails, and
they've all been hyper-masculine villains.
Yeah, so this is different. And there's one, I mean, honestly, in terms of the costume, there's one scene in Rio where he turns up with, you know,
sunglasses with the gold chain round and like a purple lilac sequined chemise and like thing. And I'm like, you look like someone's aunt. You, I really feel like you're about to bust out a tray of sangria. It is really strange. Like, good for you for trying something different, but like, is it margarita hour? That's what it feels like. He really needed like.
I really
a
hope he got to keep his wardrobe because they would have given him as much money possible. But like, I can wear this.
Yeah,
because he's kind of like, you know, motorbike.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of guy.
Yeah. But he, I really, he should have had like a side something to do some energy with. But he. God bless me. But he's the villain now for the next three films.
Oh, is he?
Yeah. Oh, James, this film ends on a cliffhanger, by which I mean the editor went, and we'll stop there.
Oh, is it like Lord of the Rings 1?
Huge,
like hard end.
Huge meat cleaver. No, it's the more like end of The Hobbit 2 with like, you know, what have we done? Cleaver down, end of the film, put it in the can, get them back for the next one. It's maddening. Do you have any questions?
I think what has happened... I mean, look, I don't think you are wrong. I've not seen this film. And I think when presented with the option of seeing this film, it was a real sort of take it or leave it of I previously enjoyed these films and found them fun. But I think what has clearly happened is you're not wrong. Everything you've said is correct. Over the years that the Fast films have come out, they've sort of been enduring and ever-growing, these great ensemble casts, sweeping, you know, the stakes are... And the budgets are rising every time. And it's similar to like a Mission Impossible. It's sort of around 4 or 5. It really sort of reset the tone and rediscovered itself, rebooted and sort of just unstoppable train from there. You have joined in at the height of a heavy metal song.
Yes.
Like right at the chorus. Yeah. And you've walked into the concert and it's just blaring. And I'm not saying heavy metal is for everyone, but for some people who have been there for the entire song, have been built up slowly. And I think when I've been paying attention to movie culture, pop culture, and people watch the trailers for the new Fast films who absolutely love it, love what it's become, love the scale of it, people watch it with, especially the trailers, because there's always like a big stunt that is just beyond belief, which is what are they going to do this time to, you know, completely blow us out of the water? I think for me, critically, Fast 7 was sort of the peak of where you know you were going to enjoy these films, and that was the one where in Dubai they drove a Bugatti out of one skyscraper. They fired an RPG. The explosion managed to propel the car that landed into the other skyscraper. That was sort of like the peak. This is just insane. I think what's clearly happened is nothing you said is wrong. And this one, I would never have said that, George, you're going to love Fast 10, but I think you've turned up at the worst possible time, just by a happenstance. To do it, I think I've seen everyone. Wow. Maybe I haven't seen 9.
One with John Cena.
I don't think I've seen that one, but I've seen up to 8.
I mean, I agree, and I think it's I'm not the audience for this. I agree. I've come into this very late. There are people who've probably seen other, you know, and who might defend it better.
Yeah.
And I accept that it was an experiment. I was just a straw poll.
You said it's my first Fast film, and we'll see.
It'll be my last.
Like, it won't be. I was like, I don't think you're going to come out and be like, oh my God, I'm going to watch 1 through 9 tomorrow. I really wouldn't have been expecting that to happen. But I was looking. I saw some pretty poor reviews, and I saw some of like certain enthusiast sites really defending it. I think based on your review, based on the runtime and the fact that it's a part one of now what I hear is part of 3 parts, I don't think I'm going to push myself to go and see it, especially now you've seen it for the show and we don't need to cover it.
Also, so it's directed by Louis Leterrier, who did the Transporter movies and did The Incredible Hulk and did Grimsby. So kind of like Euro action kind of feel. And yeah, there's a whole big set piece in Rome and you kind of like, you kind of get that vibe. You mentioned Mission Impossible. That's a really good point because coming out of this film, I just thought, God, Mission Impossible films really...
I think they deliver.
They do so well. These films, the Fast films, make the Mission Impossible films look really good.
I think you're right. I think this is a way to show this.
The crucial thing is, you know, we've all seen the behind-the-scenes footage of Tom Cruise being like, this is what we're doing. We're driving a motorbike over a mountain to do all this stuff. We're doing all these big stunts. And what Mission Impossible does, in its terms of its production, it looks at the challenges of reality and the obstacles, and it grabs the bull by the horns and it's like, we're going to engage that. We're going to get Tom Cruise, we're going to strap him to the side of an airplane.
We're doing spy, espionage, if
you want big stunts, we will commit to doing it and really trying to ride this bull to deliver it. Same goes for Top Gun Maverick. You want jets. Of course, we could just CGI them. Mm. No, let's fly the jets ourselves.
When Top Gun Maverick got announced, you and I were like, really? They're going to do Top Gun again?
I know.
That was the sentiment.
But the flip side, obviously, with the fast films is just like, yeah, we could do that, but we'll just CG it. We'll just get around it every single way. We're not going to actually meet the obstacle. And I think, as an audience member, I've just felt like saying, why am I here? Why do you need me here? Because there's nothing for me to engage in. Normally, films, they create, especially action films like this, they create a dramatic situation that you go, cool, how are they going to get out of this one? And then the joy is the film revealing a way that you didn't expect for them to get out in a very enjoyable way. But this one just goes, here's a dramatic situation. You go, that's ridiculous. And they go, yeah, you think that's ridiculous? This is how they're going to get out of it. Mm. Oh, that's just completely, yeah, no internal logic at all. Let's carry on. So there's that. I think also, having just talked about Sisu, it goes to show that you can have the biggest budget in the world. You can have the biggest stars. Mm. I don't know how much Fast X cost, but I'm guessing it's like probably nearer 200 million, yeah, something like that.
Plus.
But Sisu, nuts and bolts, short, stripped down, but effective in dealing with its set pieces. Show, don't tell, has a real clear idea. And it's amazing that Sisu is in many ways just as ridiculous as a Fast and Furious film.
Yeah.
But it is much more enjoyable and much more engaging for... Yeah. You know, probably 90% of the less of the budget. Yeah. Look, I mean, I've said what I've said ad nauseum. There's stuff like this online. It doesn't matter what I say. Let me know.
I would love to hear from Fast fans. And I don't mean that in a way that I want to sort of scrutinize. I just would be curious to hear.
If anyone
is seeing Fast 10 and if you've been following for the whole series, is this film working for you? Add some context that, me and George might not have.
Also, look, I said at the beginning, it's bad. I say that, but I've seen bad films. Normally, you can just see it falling apart before your eyes. Yeah. And you go, oh, this is annoying. I don't think I mean it like that. It's more that I really came out of it thinking, I don't think I've seen a film. I think I've just seen noise. But I really would be happy for someone to clarify. If someone has seen this and had a good time.
Here's why it's special.
Great. I'm so glad for you. I'm happy that it's working for someone. For me, I just couldn't get my head around it. And I thought it just did not work.
Well, guys, if you want to send in your thoughts, send them into hello@popkitchenpodcast.com and we'll read them out on the show.
Let's read some emails.
Let's do it.
We've got some great emails that have come in about film topics far and wide. We've got a few, though, that we'd like to start off with about Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, which is a film that is clearly having a great reaction with people. We both liked it, and it's getting it's doing very well at the box office, and it's just clearly connecting with people in a lot of ways. There's a lot of love for it.
Yeah.
And the first email we have, it's a YouTube comment.
Nice.
Shall I read this out for us, James?
Do it.
From DaveTube145, who says, I agree with James about movies pulling their punches, but I also understand what George is saying. That's good. He understands.
Yeah, I like to be understood, yeah.
This was about, I think, your point about how it was pulling its punches about saying someone's going to die and then go, no, just kidding.
Yeah, and I've noticed a lot of other films doing it. These flies.
You've got a lot of flies.
I know.
Did someone die in here?
I don't know. They're really sort of... it's the annoying flies that fly in pentagons. You know the flies that... Go on, George's getting it. Go on. Oh, he's smart. Shall I open that door and see if he can?
Yeah, that's a good one. Yay! All right.
I would really rather not have a story lead me one way, only to say, psych, just kidding, we would never let that happen. And this is true to the comics in which way they always go, we're going to kill Bruce Wayne or whoever. And it's going to be for real this time. But then 6 issues later, it's like, okay, look, Bruce is back because of this reason. This is part of why I've stopped reading Marvel and DC comics. I would rather they have the guts to go through a major change / decision and face the consequences than for it all to be fluff to sell the next comic / movie.
Stakes and consequences is a thing you and I keep mentioning as being important. And I think we're noticing when their rules are established and not followed.
Yes.
And it really sort of breaks your commitment and engagement with a piece of cinema.
So the next email is from Trevor from LA.
From LA.
Now, this email came in prior to our recording.
Reaching out to Trevor.
So last show, we mentioned Trevor. We wanted to know how he's doing. And then before that episode came out, Trevor actually wrote in and said, long time no speak.
Yeah.
And then that episode came out and Trevor, I think, has subsequently got in touch. But anyway, so Trevor comes back and says, cheers, boys, it's Trevor from LA. No, he doesn't talk like that. He just says, hi, boys, it's Trevor from LA. I'm hoping you react to this email like it's Johnny English Reborn. It's been a long time, but you're delighted it's here.
We are.
I also really enjoyed Guardians 3. I thought it was a very fond farewell to these characters, and it's really a testament to James Gunn and the chemistry of this cast that in less than a decade, these characters went from being virtually unknowns to being arguably Marvel's most popular ensemble. That's a very good point.
Very good point.
I feel like they will be missed in the way that Tony Stark and Steve Rogers will not. Yeah, I see that. something I noticed and wanted to get your thoughts on. There's a scene where the high evolutionary puts a turtle through millions of years of evolution in seconds, but he's still frustrated by the results. In Ant-Man Quantumania, which we've just done a spoiler, watch out for that later in the week, a spoiler discussion about, one of the subplots is Hank's study of ants, who is convinced of their intelligence. Then when the ants get sucked into the quantum realm, yes, I remember this, they experience a time dilation and undergo millions of years in evolution in moments and become an advanced civilization that saves the day. Watching the turtle scene in Guardians 3, I was reminded of that. I couldn't help wonder if that connection was deliberate. I think it's completely coincidental, and I think that James Gunn was deliberately operating on a completely different realm. And I'm sure that if anyone walked up to James Gunn while he was making Guardians 3 and was like, oh, there's this thing in the multiverse, I think he went, la, 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 don't want to hear it, bye, 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 and carried on. So interesting coincidence, but I think not much. In terms of Guardians 3, two quick things. What do we think about Marvel's first F-bomb? I mean, it was there. I didn't really care. It was fine. There was a...
You're allowed one, aren't you, for a 12A?
In a 12A in the UK. And James Gunn said that apparently the Russo brothers had put an F-bomb in Endgame. I think it was when Tony Stark... But they subsequently took it out. So they were going to put an F-bomb in Endgame. It's when I think Tony Stark does the snap or whatever. And
Iron Man.
Yeah, basically. And Kevin Feige saw it and was like, it's fine, but like... You know, this would be like your legacy. And the Russo brothers were like, yeah, we don't want this to be our legacy that we did Endgame and it's got the F-bomb in it. So they took it out. And James Gunn was like, showed Kevin Feige, and Kevin Feige was like, yeah, it's fine. But you know, like this, I had the same conversation with the Russo brothers. Like, this could be your legacy. And James Gunn was like, fuck, great. Yeah, that's amazing. I'd love that to be my legacy. And then the second thing is, Nathan Fillion is always and will always be a treasure. The British Museum should steal him and protect him forever. Lol. I do really enjoy Nathan Fillion. Stuff. Have him in more, please. Long live the king. T'Challa, obviously not Charles. Trevor from LA. Thank you, Trevor, very much for your thoughts. I'm going to just barrel through the next Guardians stuff. Next one on Guardians. This one is from Josh, who says, hi, lads. Me and my partner have both taken a trip to London this weekend from Liverpool and managed to catch Guardians 3 while we were there. We went to the VIP experience in the O2 and had a fantastic time. Oh, God, make the most of the weekend. We both thought the movie had great pacing, was emotionally engaging, and kept us completely interested. There was even a guy texting the whole movie with his phone on full brightness, but I didn't notice it until 5 minutes towards the end when the Dog Day started playing. He obviously doesn't share the same praise for the movie as we do.
Which is a song, by the way, that's jumping back up the charts.
Good for it. Have you seen the clip of Florence watching it? Yeah. So the movie definitely got our full attention, as even Avatar 2 was ruined by similar circumstances, but nothing could ruin this movie for us. In brackets, really enjoyed the Dog Day scene as well, as it felt very Guardians. My partner only critiqued the unrealistic spaces breathability of character. This sentence, I believe Josh is trying to say how unrealistic it was that people can breathe in space for such a long time.
Yeah, okay.
But I feel like
which we talked about.
Yeah, but I feel like that those films have established the rules that they operate in and stuck to them. So that people freeze a little bit, blow up a little bit, and then they can maybe be revived if you get there in
Who
time.
Who else floats through space in like Thor can, but he's demigod, right?
He's fine. Captain Marvel, she's fine. But in all the Guardians films, they kind of float and get a bit frozen.
Yeah,
and
their necks kind of, sort of like...
Yeah, and then they kind of microwave them. They get back to react. Okay. And I thought there was possibly one too many musical scenes, but completely understood why, considering the tone. We even went to Buckingham Palace Gardens the next day for a party, but we still said the movie was our favourite part of our visit to London. Isn't that great?
I think you could do anywhere in the world, but that was the favourite bit you did.
I didn't enjoy having to wait to listen to the pod, as I usually listen immediately, but I wanted zero expectations going in, so it could completely surprise me. Me and my partner even went to the cinema on the Wednesday before to watch Big George Foreman. That was a film that came and went.
Yeah, I didn't.
Finished at the same time as, which finished at the same time as a Guardian showing on opening day. And so we ran out of George Foreman with our fingers in our ears going, la, 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 la. Just an interesting fact to share. Just an interesting fact to share. Sean Gunn plays young Rocket and Kraglin, and Michaela Hoover plays Floor and Nova Prime's assistant, and both have therefore had two roles in Guardians movies. Also, Nathan Fillion actually also has a role in the first Guardians. He has a voice as one of the CGI monsters in the prison who says, I'm going to slather you up and do something like that. Kind regards to Josh. Thank you, Josh, for your email. I was in Liverpool just the other day. Lovely place.
That is a thing, by the way, when you're in a multiplex and you see people coming out of the screen. I had that when I went to go see Ant-Man. I saw young teens going, oh, and the bit where thing. And I did that to be like, occupied my phone, TikTok, because people do come out and they're obviously talking about the film.
Yeah, that's it.
You could be like, you could really get screwed.
They should have a one-way system. You have to go out, you know.
Soundproofed,
And lastly, our last email on Guardians 3 is this from Natalia, who says, "Hey, James and George, I have to say, just looking
loads
at this,
of hearts.
Loads of heart emojis, which we love.
Very nice.
Hey, James and George, love the podcast, heart. Longtime fan and listener, double heart. Thanks to the podcast, I've been more involved in the cinema world and have recently started to notice that I now pay attention to many previously unnoticeable details. So I can say for sure that your podcast and passionate approach to everything you do has helped me to grow and become a better film lover. Yes, many thanks for that. We love that. Natalia, you are welcome. This is why we do it.
And a heart.
A heart emoji to you. Thank you so much. Watched Guardians of the Galaxy 3 a couple of days ago and then caught up with the episode about the film.
I love that people are saving it.
Yes.
Love that.
Like a little
secret you've got.
Guardians 3 appears to be one of the best Marvel films honestly, I think Guardians 3 appears to be one of the best Marvel films throughout the history, and I can hardly name a Marvel film that covers so many moral and ethical aspects. Mm. The film made me cry at a couple of instances and became one of my top favorites, perhaps after or even the same spot
George
with Endgame.
Exciting.
I'm assuming, Natalia, that you are writing this very passionately, perhaps on your phone.
But not left to send from my iPhone.
Yes, which we appreciate. Yeah. So it might be even better than Endgame, you say. This is the interesting bit. I teach ethics to med students, which makes the way you write that, I think, are you American? Are you American,
med
Canadian?
Students.
Med students. I teach ethics. That sounds like a very scrubsy.
Yeah. I got my ethics class.
Yeah, I got my ethics. Yeah. Dr. Cox got ethics. Anyway, I teach ethics to med students and plan to discuss the film with my students in terms of its ethical aspects, moral stances of the characters, etc. Hopefully the discussion will be at least partially as fun as your podcast. Another heart emoji. Another one back to you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks to you, I've started to implement more films and film discussions in my lectures. Double heart back to you.
I loved it when at school, when a professor or like even at uni or at school, when you're like analyzing stuffy literature, but then your teacher or professor brings in something really popular that you love from pop culture and makes comparison. You're like, oh, you're just talking about Darth Vader in relation to like Iago from Othello. And I'm like, oh, I'm so engaged now.
Keep on being great. Natalia, that's what she says. Look, Natalia, although you sign off Natalie, but your email says Natalia, so I'm going to say Natalia because I feel like it's the more official one.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for that email. That's so that's very kind, and that I love that you're reconnecting with film and that you're going to include it in your lectures. Yeah. Like that's just so great, and I hope your students really appreciate it too. That's fantastic. That is all the correspondence we have on Guardians 3. But as you can tell, people having really animated, engaged response to that film that we haven't seen with Marvel films for a while, and I think they should be watching that film closely. But also, in a way, it's like, shocker, if you make a film that cares about your characters and has a good script and is emotionally engaging, shocker, people will love it. Anyway,
this next email is from Ross, who says, "Hey fellas, second time email submitter, hoping to be a prospective friend of the show."
We've heard your application is pending, Ross.
Patent pending. No, I'm kidding.
Everyone's a friend. Welcome.
Everyone's a friend. It honestly feels that every week when I'm listening to the podcast, I'm finding a compulsion to write in, and that's not feasible. So I suggest that we find a convenient time to meet up so we can talk about every film we've ever seen that should hopefully sort it. Sound good? Great. Reason for this particular email is a couple of things. I wanted to weigh in with my favorite movie insult, based on a recent listener submission. Do you remember this insult? I love it in Troy when Brad Pitt says to Brian Cox, "You sack of wine." Mild words, but spat out with such disdain and venom that it cracks me up every time. I do remember that.
Do you?
I've never heard of someone being called a sack of wine.
You also said that very much like Brian Cox.
I wanted to do it justice.
Sack of wine.
Brad Pitt.
I think unintentionally
sack
you
of,
said
that's because Brad Pitt does like a sort of British-esque attempt at British-esque. Also, sack of wine is a very sort of like old school reference when wine would have been in sacks.
Yes. Yeah,
it's not like a barrel. It's not a bottle.
Like a hot water bottle looking.
Yes, there's like sort of lined leathery things on the side of a camel. Sack of wine. My actual question is based on a recent viewing where I, a 32-year-old man, experienced The Godfather for the first time. It had always been a film blind spot for me, but even without watching it, I felt I knew the film, could predict its plot and its characters based on other mob/gangster movies. Just from the famous Don Corleone quotes, I felt had his character's number and assumed he was ruthless, violent, bloodthirsty ass of a bloke. Mm. But what I saw instead shook me to my core. saw a man haunted and burdened by responsibility and necessity. Mm. He did whatever was necessary to protect his family. I really felt for him and was blown away by how I had misconceived the character and, to be honest, the film in general. I was basing it a little off Goodfellas, which I feel is entertaining, but violence for violence's sake and lacking heart. Mm. The Godfather, for me, had so much heart. I know this is a hilariously not a hot take, but The Godfather is really, really good. I'm in love with it. What revered films do you have preconceptions of which ended up being totally different to what you eventually thought? All the best as always, Ross.
Oh my god, guys, the news is in. Did you hear The Godfather? Who knew?
No, it's funny when that happens, when you're like, oh my god, actually the thing that's really good is actually really good.
That actually is kind of my experience with The Godfather as well. Like when I went back and watched it like in my early 20s, having seen bits of it when I was younger, I was like, oh, it is actually really good. It is as good as everyone says.
I love like last year and a half when I've watched a really good film for the first time, I'm like, oh, that thing that everyone derives everything from. Yeah, no shit.
Ross, I hope you enjoy Godfather Part 2 as well.
Yeah,
and I hope you enjoy The Offer if you want to go and watch that as well. The TV series on Paramount Plus. Good fun.
George, any revered films did you have a preconception of which ended up being totally different to what you eventually thought? What about Jurassic Park when you watched that? The first time, no.
Well, last year.
Yeah.
Kind of. No, I still was too familiar with it kind of in the ether. I think... it's a hard one.
Mm.
I'm trying to think of where my expectations have been completely... surprised, like, oh, that was not the film I thought it was going to be. We'll mull it over
and we'll discover it on like a Tuesday morning and I'll go, that film.
Yeah, it'll come to us.
We'll come back
as we're waiting for a bus. This next email is from Corey, who says, hey, James and George, I just started watching Love and Death on HBO Max. Now, I'm going to quickly Google this. I think this is the Elizabeth Olsen series. There's just too much content out at the moment.
Jesse Plemons.
Jesse Plemons,
oh,
Elizabeth Olsen.
Do we have this in the UK yet?
I don't know if we do. Maybe it's coming. Hey, it says it's Hulu's. Right? Oh, no, HBO Max. Interesting.
Interesting.
I don't know if we have this here yet. But we will find out soon. Got a bit of a mixed review on Rotten Tomatoes there, but anyway.
Well, as you can tell, we haven't seen it.
So yes. I'm curious on your thoughts about it, if either of you have seen it. No, we have not. So far, it seems interesting, but there's something weird about it. Is it because Elizabeth Olsen and Jesse Plemons were so recognizable in their breakout roles, Scarlet Witch / Todd from Breaking Bad, that they stick out a bit too much? Or is it because of the tone cinematography?
I think Jesse Plemons has come out of his Todd Breaking Bad show.
He's great.
He's a really good guy.
I like Elizabeth Olsen. Sure I can answer that because we haven't seen it, but tell you what, we'll keep an eye out for it. And maybe if anyone else has seen Love and Death, they can comment.
This next one is from Charlie. Says, hello, Pop Kitchen.
Hello.
I am a faithful listener to your show each week.
Oh my God, somebody goes to church regularly.
A priest.
No, they're always there. Yeah. I mean, someone who, congregation, a member of the congregation.
I am picturing that you are like Silas in the Da Vinci Code with like a minimalist dark room, like instead of a wooden cross, it's like
our
picture of like that. And you've got some weird chain that you strap to your leg.
Nomine Patris, the Spiritus Sanctus, the sirens are on our end.
Tear bloods just coming out, bloods and tears coming out of your eyes.
What is
I
trying to say?
I'm a faithful listener to your show each week, though must admit, I only listen to each episode once, unlike some of the more avid listeners.
I mean,
how could you get the subtlety of our show?
The nuances. Of course, that's absolutely fine. And there's no obligation to go back
course,
and watch
that's
it.
Normal. No offense to the people who do.
Yeah, we love the people who do the deep dives.
It's
but
very normal for people to listen once to like some. No, it's harsh. Like disposable, transient.
Yeah, it's okay.
Present.
Charlie, it's absolutely fine. You are faithful, but we understand.
We appreciate you, Charlie, and appreciate the people who watch it two or three times. You God bless you. You
keep church. Everyone's welcome.
My girlfriend and I were recently discussing how some actors just have a face that either is or isn't fit for period drama. Yeah. This was spurned from the recent god-awful version of Persuasion with Dakota Johnson. Dakota just looks like a woman who's seen an iPhone.
Right, this is a take I've seen online quite a few times.
Yeah. My other thoughts were Cameron Diaz in Gangs of New York and Channing Tatum in Hateful Eight. Are there any actors or actresses that have ruined your immersion due to their presence not matching the film's setting? As not to be wholly negative, what about some actors who fit period pieces perfectly? Anya Taylor-Joy being a great example, ergo The Northman and The Vavitch. Keep up the great work, lads. All the best, Charlie. P.S., aren't you guys familiar with the work of British director Ben Wheatley, currently making Hollywood strides, but his early catalogue is brilliantly thought-provoking. I direct you to Kill List and A Field in England, especially if you like films that leave you with something to discuss and mull over with friends. We'll get back to that. But George, faces appearing sort of out of... place.
I don't. I have seen that take online a few times. That sort of like slightly humorous thing. And it's funny
how you dress someone. They sort of have a modern how they look. Face.
I get it. It's like I kind of laugh at it for like a minute, but then I'm like, no. Frankly, I think any actor can be in any period thing because it's all suspension of disbelief. And I don't read people in that way. The only time that I find people distracting is if they have. Brought they have such no it's more like they have brought the baggage of another more famous role with them. So for example in let's say The Hateful Eight, if Matt LeBlanc turned up it might be a bit distracting, okay? but other than that, I think anyone has a license to be in a film, right? Okay, it'd be good if he turned up in that film because then we'd have another one for the game.
Eat a sandwich in the corner.
Oh, chef. So no, I don't. I think because any actor, I believe that any actor can bring anything to any role. I'm sorry.
I feel like Jesse Plemons has an old face, like for oldie times.
I agree. There are actors who are who look like they would fit. They're just the character actors you typically call would fit any time period and any place. Like Kyle Chandler, I think always looks best. In like fits the 1940s, he was in King Kong,
by Espionage. Kong,
exactly.
Totally.
Just like
even in The Wolf of Wall Street, which is like 90 set or 80 set, he looks like
he's in the 50s. And that's a good example. But I don't think that the other way around. Do you have anything else to add?
No, I think that's totally fair.
On Ben Wheatley, I've seen Kill List and I've seen Free Fire, which I thought was okay. But Kill List, I really like, and it's got a really good ending, and that film really. Unnerves you. It's really atmospheric.
The High Rise with Tom Hiddleston.
Oh, I saw that. That was not that great.
No, I found it a little bit.
I saw that at the cinema. Boring.
Boring. Yeah. Really, really boring and confusing. It just kind of lost me.
But Kill List, I rate strongly. This next email is from Jack Parr, who says, a fellow listener. That's the subject line. Hi, guys. I discovered your podcast and absolutely love it.
Yes,
put that dramatic pause in. Sorry, Jack. The way you break down films is intelligent and articulate.
Oh, thank you.
I'm an actor and writer, and I feel silly listening to you guys. I feel silly listening to you guys due to the fact I actually do this for a living. Nice. Don't feel silly. It's fine. Very inspirational listening to how detailed you go in with each criticism. Love it. Thank you, Jack. That's really kind.
Very kind.
Anyway, I listened to the Netflix Slate episode, that was a few weeks ago, check it out, of What's to Come. I would love to go to events like this myself. I'd love to see what's on Apple Slate and other streamers like that. Do you have to be invited to these events or is there a way to get tickets? I'd love to know your method if it's not top secret. Thanks, guys. Loving it, Jack Parr.
They are invited. They are invited things. Only, yeah. I mean, look, we very kindly get sent an email from someone at Netflix who are always very lovely, very nicely invite us to go to these things. They are like media press events. Some of these things are more media PR sort of newspapery things, and some of them
more
are
press
more
heavy and
press
some
heavy
of them
and
more...
some of them you find we're invited as like an influencer capacity and we're very lucky to sort of do a little bit of both, which is really nice. But we will, as always, every time we go to an event where we're given exclusive access to cover something, we will always do it on the show. We're going to tell you exactly what was said or anything that interests us. We will always do it,
because the thing is that they, as much as you're an actor and somebody in the industry, from Netflix's point of view, in Netflix, using this as an example, it's like, well, you're just a consumer and you're just someone who's just a potential customer. But because we do this, we have an audience and we have they know that, but if they tell us this information, there we go. We record an episode and then we disseminate
the
information.
We just want content. We want to be able, like, this is cool, this is coming
out. We know, we disseminate the information kind of for them, and that's kind of press journalist kind of thing. But don't worry, stay tuned though, Jack. We'll give
anytime
you all the
updates. Anytime we're invited to something cool and something cool happens, we will always cover it to the extent that we think is relevant for you guys. So guys, another reason, just subscribe, get on the socials, just do it. Next one is from Zoe. He says, hello guys, I would like to say that I'm a fairly new to my interest in film and find your podcast has really helped me expand my knowledge. And listening to you guys is now one of my favorite things to do to pass the time.
Oh, nice.
I don't have a lot of other friends who like films, so I like hearing both of your thoughts on new releases and all films in general.
Thank you.
Recently, I watched The Last of Us and really enjoyed it. I combined my watching experience with listening to both the official Last of Us podcast and the unofficial Last of Us podcast by Bold Move. The way the releases came out, I would watch the episode first and then the instant take from the unofficial podcast, the official podcast, and then the full take from the unofficial again.
Wow.
It was interesting to hear the thought processes right from the creators of the show, then takes of the fellow filmgoers. My question is, have you ever done this with a TV show? And what are your thoughts on consuming media in this way? Do you think it would be too much? Do you think it would too much sway the overall conclusions of how you were supposed to feel as the watcher/listener by listening to other people's opinions? For me, I think having the double perspective of the unofficial podcast was a good balance, but my opinions of the show have probably been swayed anyway. I did, however, love the show, and listening to the podcast all through the week kept me looking forward to the next episode. Sorry if that was a bit long, but I haven't heard of anybody else who has done this, so I wanted to see what you guys thought. All the best, Zoe. I can jump in if you're...
You go first.
Well, I was going to say, I've mixed feelings about this, but I have done a version of that. Not to the same extent where you have, where you've gone like official, unofficial, but I have with films, we've talked about like, you don't want to hear a review, read a review, like right before you're going into a film, because it sort of really sort of awkwardly informs your impression before you go in. But I have had films where I've saved interviews and like full on like hour long review discussions for like on my way home from the cinema. And I have enjoyed that with some films. Like I think I did it, I saved like 2 hours worth of podcast after I saw The Batman. And I really enjoyed, like, that was a 3-hour film, and I just got loads of like fan stuff. But I have found that when it comes to like really review based podcasts, you don't want to come in straight with a review afterwards, but an interview with someone who wrote it, directed it, starred in it is always good to hear. Yes. That's always really nice.
I agree. Getting primary information from the horse's mouth, as it were, from the directors and all the people behind it, and hearing their explanation of why they've done something in the film, whether successful or otherwise, is interesting. I agree. When I come out of a film, I usually give it at least half a day, I'd probably say, before I actually engage with fellow reviews, because I want to make sure that I'm digesting it in my own way and having my own thoughts percolate it. And I don't want any other external influence to go in there, because I have in previous times come out of a film, read a review and found that I've read it too soon after I've come out of it. And it's then affected the way I think about it. You almost want to like solidify and bake your opinion.
Yeah.
And then you engage in the other opinions just to know and shape your opinion against that. So, that was it.
And also, I'm not saying you should be suspicious of like publisher endorsed podcasts, but like, so I have there's like PlayStation podcasts I listen to that are independent and they review the games, they talk about them freely, and then there's like PlayStation endorsed podcasts they're just marketing, right? But the people on them obviously can't, they're not reviewing the content, but they're going to sit there and talk about how great this feature is. There's nothing wrong with that, but I don't use that as like I'm like, oh, this is just like an endorsed podcast to like interview someone or to tell me like what I can expect to do versus the review. And they're sort of, you have to consider them differently. But there's nothing wrong with them. I think they, if you look at the charts on film and TV, on podcasts, they are littered with these official show podcast shows.
Yes.
Like there's The Last of Us one, there's a Succession one, any Crown, big show, The Crown, they all do really well. And I think people do want to just like digest and stir on an episode they've just seen. So they're definitely popular.
Thank you for that email.
Thank you.
The next one is from Joe, who an email titled Best Film Character Names. Love the pod. I've been a constant listener ever since I discovered you around episode 4 on YouTube.
Whoa.
Episode
Hello.
4.
God Quattro. Bless nice. You. Joe. Well, Joe, with that last name, has written in before.
Oh, I think so.
I think Joe's a friend of the show.
You know what? You are now, Joe. I mean, episode 4.
Episode 4.
That's like, hey, you old bastard. Yeah. We've been round the block a few times.
I've been listening since episode 4. Shut up, Joe.
Back in those days, they used to do food, don't you know? But he does say in brackets, highest quality produced podcast in town, by the way. Thank you very much, Joe.
We do try.
Just wanted to ask what your favorite film character names are of all time. Here are some of mine to include. Anton Chigurh from No Country for Old Men. Mm-hmm. Patches O'Houlihan from Dodgeball.
Great shout.
Shooter
Patches O'Houlihan. All right, sport.
Shooter McGavin from Happy Gilmore.
Yeah.
Marty McFly,
yes.
Back to the Future, and Vincent Vega from Pulp Fiction.
A lot of alliteration going on there.
And not to be confused with Vic Vega from Reservoir Dogs. And there was an idea that Tarantino was going to do a film with them being brothers and stuff, but it never happened.
I'd like to add Cliff Booth.
Clifton Booth, yeah. And
here's my stunt double, Cliff Booth.
And he says, best of all, Chaz Michael Michaels from Blades of Glory. Yeah. Never seen Blades of Glory.
Oh, Blades of Glory is amazing. Yeah. Stranson Fairchild. Amazing. Amy Poehler and Will Arnett are like, they're like skater siblings that have a really like weird Freudian relationship. It's very funny. People used to tell me I sounded, when I was younger and I had floppy hair, I sound like Jimmy from Blades of Glory, which I never saw.
Right.
The guy who plays Napoleon Dynamite.
Oh, yeah. John Hader, I think.
Yeah, John Hader.
Anyway, keep up the amazing content. Joe from Liverpool. In brackets, not to be confused with the other Joe from Liverpool, who had previously emailed in with such questionable takes as Monsters University being better than Monsters, Inc.
And we've had someone come in to defend Monsters which we'll University, get to. Which I talked quite flippantly about, but I face the consequences.
James, any favourite film character names?
Yeah, I said Cliff Booth is a recent one. Neo, it's just cool.
Really?
Okay, yeah.
And it's an anagram of one.
Yeah. Morpheus, Trinity, that's cool names.
I've always liked Ferris Bueller.
Yes.
Because I've never met anyone called Ferris Bueller. Just got that kind of, hey, I'm Ferris Bueller.
Is it like, are Americans called Ferris?
It sounds quite an American name. Well, we'll have to get back to you on that one. That was the sound of my brain working.
Thank you, thank you, Joe.
I'm sure we didn't have more answers for you there, Joe, but that's just a couple.
This last one is from Harrison, who says, hello there. I just added Hello there. First, I'd like to say that my fiance and I are big fans of the show. Oh. She emailed in recently and was ecstatic that you read our email on her birthday.
Saf, wasn't it?
Yes, Harrison and Saf.
Hello, guys.
Yeah, if you didn't know, they emailed in and said that they listened together. They sat down to listen to the show together, watched the show together.
In their living room.
Which we now know is in the living room. Yeah. You and I, obviously, when we're given very little information, our imagination runs wild. And we're like, how do they listen? Where? Yeah. What are they doing? How do they sit? And then they tagged us in an Instagram story of them watching the moment where we broke the fourth wall and stared into their soul.
Brilliant.
It was really great. Thank you so much for sending that. It made her whole weekend. She screamed a little bit. And then I think I actually believe her now when she says she is your biggest fan.
She's up there. I mean, I think that's a strong claim. Yeah, go for it.
She was like an excited toddler and it was lovely.
Oh, that's really great.
We keep passing on the good word and have converted a few of our friends. My best friend is coming over to watch The Godfather this weekend after hearing you guys discuss it and realizing he's never actually seen it.
Hot take. It's really good.
It's really good, guys. We can confirm. Before I ask my question, I'd like to give a little context. I'm a writer and I'm composing a series of poems inspired by my love for film and TV and the impact it has had on my life. I love the artists that listen to the show.
I respect poets because, like, in this day and age, like, poets are like the OG content creators.
Yes.
You know, like 300 years ago.
The first memes.
Like Byron would be like, have you heard Byron's just dropped a new poem?
Yeah.
He's like, yo, it's your boy Byron, just been on a grand tour of Europe and just boom.
People would write puns and double meanings and go to the pub and read. Listen to this one, guys.
Yeah. That's so good.
It was the original, like, oh, I'm going to send you this TikTok that made me laugh.
Mate, have you heard Shelley's new poem? It's so lit.
Oh, shit. He just dropped. Everyone's seen that meme. Beethoven. Love of film and TV. The impact it's had on my life. Working title, My Life on Screen. Brackets, better suggestions are welcome. I spent a good chunk of my life at the cinema or in front of a TV screen, and I think this has largely shaped how I see the world. For instance, I watched a lot of rom-coms when I was growing up with my mum and my auntie, and this is likely the reason I'm a huge romantic, brackets, and serial crier. One poem I finished is called I Want to Be Like Jonathan Lipnicki When I Grow Up. It's about the time I became obsessed with vampires after watching The Little Vampire as a kid. I took it about as far as jumping off our shed roof in the hopes I would learn to fly.
Wow.
Remember that film, The Little Vampire?
Is Richard E. Grant in that? I think
it wouldn't be surprised. I've not. That is completely. Yeah. Is it? Was it a Disney
joke? I don't know. I can't. Stretching it, but
it's. I don't know if this is true, but it feels like a film that Christopher Columbus would have directed. But yes. I don't think that's accurate.
Columbus's second assistant director probably directed it.
I want each piece of my writing to reflect my experience watching those films, as well as how it impacted my real life or how I relate to it. I guess my question is: could you name any films that have perhaps shaped the person you are or how you see the world?
Whoa.
They don't have to be the best films in the world; just films that you feel you wouldn't be the same person now had you not seen them. Keep up the good work.
Question.
It's a pleasure to see. Much love. Many thanks, Harrison and Saf. I mean,
thank you, Harrison.
In a lot of ways, every film, every piece of art and media, it puts an impression of life upon you, and you are interpreting it or disagreeing or agreeing or falling in love or you're in disdain for all of it, and it always presents you with something you've never seen before.
You are being shaped, continually being shaped by everything in your life, from what happened to you as a child to the last film you watched, good or bad.
And think about how many Americanisms we've picked up in the UK just based on the fact that Hollywood and American cinema has been like the most prevalent, highest tier of media for so long. Like, think about how much we absorb, like, high school culture.
Yes.
And the Mean Girls is an extreme version of it, but when you see American Friends, you're like, is it like Mean Girls? Like, what is your high school really like?
We don't have anything weird with Sex Education than is British set, but then regurgitates that in its own sort of American style.
And Americans will be like, are your schools like Hogwarts?
No.
Only the really posh ones. Like Hogwarts.
There's like two of them.
That's a films that have really changed the way you look at the world.
That have perhaps shaped the person you are or how you see the world.
Shaped the person you are.
Shaped the person.
There's
I
things
am.
That sort of, I think, really paradigm shift your perspective on something.
Yeah.
I can't think of something off the top of my head, but you go, wow, I never thought of considering the world that way. The way that character chose to perceive something has changed the way I think.
I think that.
Great sci-fi.
I mean, it's
that.
Really an easy cop-out for me to just be like, oh, the before films again. Because there's things those characters say they've thought about and stuff. But we've done those.
There's nothing like a really good historical film to apply context to a moment in time that a history book would never be able to do.
I tell you what, actually, I'm going to try not. I don't think this is as like top level profound, but I've mentioned this film a few times, Dark Waters, which came out late 2019, 2020.
Yes.
Really great film with Mark Ruffalo about the DuPont pollution in America's waters and therefore the world's waters.
That's right, your Teflon guys.
To do with Teflon and PFOAs in the water. And what it's almost like a depressing realization, but what that film was really good at capturing is the level of corporate criminality and corporate negligence and corporate greed and corporate unaccountability.
Those are true life stories.
A bit like Dope Sick as well.
Yeah.
In a way that just makes you realize that the real power and the real strength in this world is unaffected and carries on almost without the actions. Over time, it is affected by the actions of collective people, but it takes years. Mm. And that's why, obviously, we love a story like that. And in the case of this lawyer who Mark Ruffalo plays, like really trying to hold these people to account. But I've often thought about that film afterwards, and I've seen that scenario played out in different news stories with different things being like, yeah, that's another case of mass corporate greed,
like,
mass
like
corporate
a system that only
violence.
Serves or is there to reward the increase of profit.
Yeah, and where no sole individual
is
responsible. It's just
but your system
spread.
Facilitates this.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get all socialist on everyone, but you do. It's like that's how you end up realizing, or you see something portray many different stories simultaneously and how that.
And that was a good paradigm shift. And of course, that idea is something that you can get elsewhere and has been articulated in different ways. But I just thought the way that it realized that in this context of this story was really powerful. Go see that film, Dark Waters. That's a really good one. People slept on that. It's
Guys,
really great.
We've run for quite a while, so we're going to cap the emails there. We still have so many because they're all so good. Keep sending them in. If you want to send us your thoughts, your questions, your concerns, your recent impressions on a film that we've talked about or a film that we should be talking about, send them in to hello@pulpkitchenpodcast.com and we'd read them out on the show. Guys, let's send it home for a game. All right, everybody, it is that time where we unwind. We do a little bit of fun trivia. We throw some fun things back and forth. It's game time. It's the end of the episode. Well done for making it. Well done for listening for this long. You're our biggest fans. We love you. We appreciate
you.
Thank you for staying with us. We're going to play some games, George. I've got two miscellaneous games for you.
Okay.
These are quick fire. Get them out. And then I have a game with the twist, but I'll get to that later.
Okay.
Right.
I like it.
This first game, ready? I'm going to give you 30 seconds to answer it. Okay. Let me get my watch. Hold on. Hold on, stay there, everyone. Pull over. Okay, stopwatch. Ready. Okay, George.
Okay.
Name me 10 disaster movies. You have 30 seconds. Your time starts now.
The Towering Inferno, San Andreas, Twister, Armageddon, Deep Impact.
Yes.
2012.
Yes.
The Day After Tomorrow.
Yes.
Disaster. Independence Day.
Yes.
Godzilla. Like, can you count those?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I would also say Knowing with Nicolas
you just
Cage.
Got that at 29 seconds. Yes, Knowing with Nicolas Cage.
Ridiculous film, but mate,
a genre we don't unpack that much, but it's there.
I feel like that has its time in the 50s and the 60s.
Yes,
there's
Sharknado
big disasters.
Would have been a real
Sharknado. I could have done all of them.
Yes. You got right to like 29.
Wow.
With
Thank
Nick
you.
Cage is
Good question.
Well, yeah, I just
disaster
thought
movies. Bit.
Disaster movies.
Did I miss any big ones?
No, I think you got all the ones that I probably would have mentioned. I'm not got it in front of me, but I was satisfied with your selection.
Any Roland Emmerich film, basically.
Yes, Roland Emmerich. You could have done this Independence Day sequel as well, which was...
Oh, that's how forgettable that was. That was with
Liam Hemsworth in there.
Right.
Right, next. Miscellaneous quickfire. Ready to go, okay? Name me 10 movies with a one-syllable title. You have 30 seconds. Your time starts now.
Once. Jaws.
Yes.
Saw.
Yeah.
He's George's like recoil. Bug. It's a William Friedkin film.
Yep.
Mud.
Yep.
Brave.
Yep. And that's time.
Jesus, that's so hard. You should have given me longer.
It's hard. It's hard, isn't it?
How many get six?
You got six. Could have had Nope. Pray.
We did those last year.
I know. It's tricky, isn't it?
That's a good question.
It's really like not working.
One syllable films.
Yeah, you can't have studied for that.
It's a good one, isn't it? What other ones I could have got? I mean, apart from
How many did you get?
June,
yes.
June.
That's a really good question.
Isn't that
okay.
good test, yeah.
Okay, so this is the meat of the game, okay? I have in front of me the films of some of the greatest filmmakers to have ever put light onto celluloid, okay? And we're going to do two rounds of this. And when I name you the famous director, you have to quickfire tell me one of their films that has been nominated for Best Picture, okay?
And if it won one, I guess that counts as well, right?
Yeah, if it won one or nominated, right? And I will go to the end and then I'm going to twist it for you. Here's a list of filmmakers. You have to tell me one of their films that has been nominated for Best Picture. This is a quick fire. Ready? 3, 2, 1. Guillermo del Toro.
Pan's Labyrinth.
No.
The Shape of Water.
Yes. Terrence Malick.
The Tree of Life.
Yes. Ridley Scott.
Gladiator.
Yes. David Lean.
Lawrence of Arabia.
Yes. Christopher Nolan.
In Dunkirk.
Yes. George Lucas.
Raiders. No. Star Wars.
Yes. Oliver Stone.
Platoon.
Yes. Sidney Lumet.
Sidney Lumet is 12 Angry Men.
Stanley Kubrick.
Oscar. Eyes Wide Shut. The Clockwork Orange.
Yes. Steven Spielberg.
Same Private Ryan.
Yes. Clint Eastwood.
Million Dollar Baby.
Okay. You did very well.
Thank you.
That's done. Now, here's the twist. These are all very famous filmmakers. You know, chances are you throw a dart on one of these filmmakers, you're going to get one of their films that's been nominated for Oscar. Now you have to do it again, but you can't list any of the films that you just said. So we're going to do it one more time.
Okay.
The same film.
So, do those other filmmakers have other films?
Yes, they all have other films that have been nominated for Best Picture. Ready? 3, 2, 1. Guillermo del Toro.
Pinocchio?
No. Recent.
After the Shape of Water. Oh, A Nightmare Alley?
Yes. Terrence Malick.
Thin Red Line?
Yes. Ridley Scott. Also fairly recent, 8 years ago.
8 years ago. The Martian?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
David Lean?
Dr. Zhivago.
Yes. Christopher Nolan.
Inception.
Yes. George Lucas.
Not American Graffiti.
Yes.
American Graffiti.
Yes.
Wow.
Oliver Stone.
Salvador.
Which was the first one you said?
I said Platoon.
Yeah.
Salvador or no, don't tell me. It's just not Snowden. Not Oliver Stone. Oh, Born on the 4th of July.
Yes. Sidney Lumet.
He did so much. The Verdict?
Yes. Stanley Kubrick.
Not The Shining. Shining? No. Dr. Strangelove?
Yes. Steven Spielberg.
E.T.?
Yeah. Clint Eastwood.
Gran Torino?
No.
Changeling? No. Mystic River? No.
Yes.
Mystic River?
Yes, Mystic River. It's harder, isn't it?
He couldn't used to do Mystic River. He directed that.
Yeah, apparently it's on this list. It's a good workout.
I did it.
Are you ready to go again with a new set of directors?
Fuck yeah, let's do it.
Wow.
Yeah? Oh my God. It's a good workout. So you've got
to give me another two rounds.
So I'm going to give you another two rounds. So I'm going to give you one pass through.
Okay.
And then you have to do it again, but not name the films you've done.
Okay.
How are you doing at home? Because this is hard. Because I thought you know your awards, you know your thing, but I thought, can you do it twice over? Okay, George. Here is a list of filmmakers. You have to tell me which one of their films has been nominated for Best Picture. This is quickfire. Ready? 3, 2, 1, go. The Coen Brothers.
No Country for Old Men.
Yes. Paul Thomas Anderson.
Paul Thomas Anderson. There Will Be Blood.
James Cameron.
Avatar.
Yes. Alejandro Iñárritu.
That is Birdman.
Yes. David Fincher.
Gone Girl?
No.
Benjamin Button.
Yes. Alfred Hitchcock.
Vertigo?
No.
Psycho?
No.
Marnie? No.
No.
Strangers on a Train?
No.
Oh, God!
Moving on. Tarantino.
North by Northwest?
No.
Tarantino, Pulp Fiction.
Yes. Billy Wilder.
The Apartment.
Yes. Francis Ford Coppola.
The Godfather.
Yes. John Ford.
John Ford. Is that The Man Who Would Be King?
No.
John Ford. The Searchers.
No.
Shane? No.
No. Martin Scorsese.
The Wolf of Wall Street.
Yes. William Wyler.
The Searchers? Shane? Wuthering Heights?
Yes.
Is that the last one?
Yeah, that's the last
one. God, I did that at uni. That's why I know that one. Jesus Christ.
Some easy ones and some hard ones in there, but they're all fair. And they've
so these are all filmmakers that have been nominated more than once for Best Picture.
These are easily the ones I've listed. I mean, that's
Hitchcock.
The last.
How can I not get Hitchcock? That's
so spaced. I would reveal it to you, but there are with Hitchcock there are
several answers.
Where is Hitchcock? There are four answers for Alfred Hitchcock.
All right, let's do it again. Come on.
And some of the hardest ones have some of the they're the oldest ones, but they've got like 13 films that were nominated. Right. The problem is they're sort of from, you know, up to 80 years ago.
I think I know that William Wyler one.
So you ready? We're gonna go in again, the same list of filmmakers, but you have to name another film. You cannot use any of the films that you used in the last round. Ready? We're gonna go in again. 3, 2, 1. The Coen Brothers.
Fargo.
Yes. Paul Thomas Anderson.
Magnolia?
No.
Punch Drunk Love?
No.
Licorice Pizza?
Yes. James Cameron?
Avatar 2?
Yes. Alejandro Iñárritu?
Not Birdman. He did, what did he do? For the one before that. The one, The Revenant?
Yes. David Fincher?
The Social Network?
Yes. Alfred Hitchcock?
The Birds?
No.
Oh, God.
We'll do that at the end afterwards. Tarantino?
Django?
Yes. Billy Wilder.
Some Like It Hot.
No.
Some Like It Hot is not, are you even joking
me? It's not on my list.
That one, I'm sure that one. But Billy, okay. In that case, Billy Wilder. The Fortune Cookie. Billy Wilder. No.
It's hard. They are old, but never mind. Francis Ford Coppola.
Godfather Part 2.
Yes. John Ford. It's hard. You're doing very well.
John Ford, Westerns.
Martin Scorsese.
The Departed.
Yes. William Wyler.
How Green Was My Valley?
No.
William Wyler. William.
Othello.
Ben Hur. Oh, did he?
Yeah. All right. He's got loads. Well done. Okay, would you like me to read?
Can you do the Hitchcock and
shall I read? Do you know what? Shall I just read them out? So for the Coen Brothers, you can have No Country for Old Men, Fargo, A Serious Man, and True Grit.
Right.
Paul Thomas Anderson, you can have There Will Be Blood, Phantom Thread, and Licorice Pizza.
Got it.
James Cameron, Titanic and the Avatars. Alejandro Iñárritu, you have Babel, Birdman, The Revenant.
Yeah. Babel.
David Fincher, you got Benjamin Button, which you said, Social Network, and Mank.
Mank.
And then Alfred Hitchcock, it's Rebecca, Foreign Correspondent, Suspicion, and Spellbound.
Wow, they're not the OG ones.
That's why I think about it. Tarantino got Pulp Fiction, Inglourious Bastards, Django, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Billy Wilder, you've got this is hard. This is from 1944 to 1960.
Double Indemnity,
The Lost Weekend, Sunset Boulevard, Witness for the Prosecution, and The Apartment, which you said first time round. Francis Ford Coppola, you've got Godfathers 1 and 2, The Conversation, Apocalypse Now, Part 3. John Ford, you've got Aerosmith, The Informer. I mean, it's from 1930. Aerosmith, The Informer, Stagecoach, The Grapes of Wrath, Long Voyage Home, How Green Was My Valley, the quiet man, Mr. Roberts, How the West Was Won. So they've got, these old filmmakers have got loads. They just, the dominance in the Oscars in the 30s and 40s. Scorsese, you've got Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, Goodfellas, Gangs of New York, The Aviator, The Departed, Hugo, The Wolf of Wall Street, The Irishman.
Bloody hell.
That's it, killing it. And William Wyler, it's hard, but he's got so many. Dodsworth, Dead End, Jezebel, Wuthering Heights, The Letter, The Little Foxes, Miss Miniver, The Best Years of Our Lives, The Heiress, The Roman Holiday, Friendly Persuasion, Ben-Hur, Funny Girl. So, Christ. Yes, that's hard. And I think you did very well. You did better than I would have done. But that he's also got so many there. Yeah, so there you go. That was a real test,
yeah.
A real test of it. But there you go, guys. Thank you so much.
Yes.
We hope that really sort of set your tickled your appetite. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. Don't forget, we post new episodes of the show every single Wednesday.
And as you guys know, we post bonus content as well. We've got a bonus episode coming out later this week about Ant-Man Quantumania. Now that's on streaming. So
next week, we're doing Bo is Afraid. Stay tuned for that.
Yes, absolutely. And just continue. Like and subscribe. Follow us. Share us. Leave us a comment. Leave us a review. Give us a 5-star thing on Spotify. All that stuff really makes a difference. It really matters. We really appreciate your support.
Click
Thank
the
you so
subscribe
much.
Button on Spotify so you get our stuff, or in any podcast app you're listening to, get our stuff when it drops. Get the notification for when we drop an episode early Wednesday or somewhat midday Thursday.
I wanted to let you know when James and I blink, okay? Yes. We need to be up to date.
Yeah, when George has a grape in between meals, I want you to know.
So specific, but I don't.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so, thank you so much, guys. Stay tuned for next week. Thank you.
See you next week.